Thank you for that kind introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. Neighbors, though we are, we need to find one another on these close grounds, and I'm glad to have this occasion. The remarks I'll offer will help set the stage for this current crisis, and you should know at the outset that crises are a regular feature of financial markets, indeed all markets. Since 1907, there have been approximately a dozen to 15 financial crises. The uncertainty dealing with the fact that we don't have a very precise definition for crisis or panic or malaise or recession or depression. But think of it in those round terms. They are a regularity of markets. And the big lesson of that very fact, in my mind, is that we should manage ourselves, our companies, our households, our governments in ways to anticipate the regular reappearance of these events. The Panic of 1907 is a book about the events of that day. It's a very interesting item in the history of capital markets. Interesting for two reasons. One was it was one of the most severe financial crises in U.S. history, and the other is that it was the precursor to founding the U.S. Federal Reserve System. And so it was the last major event in which we saw private market mechanisms arise to correct for the excesses of the panic. Studying that episode gives us some insights into the factors that contribute to the rise of a crisis. In our book, we highlighted seven of these, and they map very, very well onto the events of today. So I won't refer to the panic of a century ago, but instead I'll talk about the events leading up to and initiating this crisis. The first factor contributing to a crisis is buoyant growth. John Maynard Keynes and Joseph Schumpeter said that we should be, in fact, less interested in episodes of recession and depression than in the booms that precede them. Why do markets go to excess and thus require these troughs to correct for the excesses? The short answer is we don't know. We don't have a great deal of insight into what causes the extremes, but it's in the buoyant moments of markets that the excessive behavior takes root. So, beginning after the recession of 2001-2002, the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates dramatically at the period roughly the latter half of 2002 to 2004. Interest rates were so low that in real terms they were negative. Now, what that means to the layperson is that the Federal Reserve was basically paying people to borrow. Well, when you do that, you sure encourage people to borrow, and as a result, borrowing in U.S. society rose dramatically. It was apparent in the indebtedness of households, particularly for consumer durables and for houses, and this lays the seeds for the boom, the bubble, as it were, in house prices. And it led to large increases in corporate indebtedness, and of course the U.S. government began to borrow very heavily during that time as well, associated with the onset of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also to finance tax cuts and the like. Big increase in debt. It was also a period of rising optimism. Consumer behavior, of course, feeds on this optimism. We had growth in speculation on the part of investors, purchasing of stocks particularly, and houses in anticipation that the trend of growth in these prices would be sustained forever. This is an economist's definition, one definition of over-optimism. It is that you foresee no correction or adjustment in prices. As we all know, prices can't grow unerringly to the sky, and It is a feature of investor and consumer behavior to simply forecast in a straight line what one's current experience is indefinitely into the future. Well, that eventually there is some settling up, some correction, and that's largely what's happened in the last 24 months. At any rate, buoyant growth is the first precursor to a crisis or panic. The second is complexity. Complexity is very important to business people and indeed individuals because it creates conditions of information asymmetry, information problems. The world is so complex, financial institutions are so complex, even individual securities become so complex that it's very difficult for individuals to know what is going on, particularly to know what these institutions or securities are worth. So you had the foundations for uncertainty. A third precondition for a crisis is the tightening of linkage, the reduction of safety buffers throughout the economy. Safety buffers are things like walking around money in your pocket that mean that if you have a sudden demand, you can actually find the change to meet the demand. Corporations keep stocks of cash and unused debt capacity. The government does too. Individuals do as well. And when you're very, very optimistic, you tend to reduce your safety buffers. Safety buffers are important in the understanding of crises and panics because they make it possible for trouble to travel. So when a member of your family runs out of money, they come to you. And of course, after a while, you run out of money. And you go to the next person, and so trouble travels. Explicitly in the banking system, there's a market for intercorporate loans that is the actual conductor through which trouble travels. When banks begin to get into difficulty, they cease lending to one another, liquidity freezes up, and the like. And that's happened in the last 24 months as well. And so buoyant growth, complexity, reduction in safety buffers. Arguably, we could point to episodes of adverse leadership, leadership at all levels, the pursuit of miscreants as a result of this crisis will go on for years and years, not least beginning at the highest levels of government. Chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, former chairman, has already confessed in a hearing before Congress that he must have been wrong in keeping interest rates so low so long. But corporations, of course, participated in this, making loans of uncertain type to less than creditworthy borrowers. And, of course, households are a part of the problem. I could point to data that show a very dramatic increase in borrowing since 1982. Such a dramatic increase that we've not seen this level of indebtedness in American society since the Second World War. The key point is that we all own this crisis. No one escapes from some degree of responsibility for what's happened and is happening now. There's a spark, ultimately. So you have this setting of tinder, as it were, and typically in every crisis there's a spark of some kind. The spark needs to be a surprise. It needs to be consequential. It needs to be unambiguous. In the panic of 1907, that spark was the earthquake in San Francisco in April of 1906. What was the spark in this crisis? I'll argue that it was the sudden revelation that subprime loans are much riskier than people ever imagined them to be. Of course, the housing market began to decline. Prices began to decline in mid-2006, but people weren't so worried. There are periodic corrections in housing prices. But the question became, what about those mortgages on those houses? Are they in trouble? Well, no one knew until a statistical firm began to publish indexes of risk on subprime mortgages. And this publication began in 2006 as well. And by November 2006, the indicators of risk increased dramatically. Well, it wasn't very long before the news, the spark, turned into fire. Institutions began to thrash and flounder, and some failed. And you have the events of the most recent episode. There's a final factor that dictates the severity and duration of a crisis, and that is what I would call collective action, the efficacy of collective action. And in 1907, it was characterized by none other than J.P. Morgan himself returning to New York City and organizing pools, rescue pools of capital to save financial institutions, industrial corporations, even the New York Stock Exchange. Today, we've delegated that rescue power to various government agencies, and we know from recent events how well that's been going. But these seven factors create a very complicated story. People keep saying, Bob, can't you boil this down to one thing that we can put in a headline or summarize in a soundbite? And the answer is no. I think that sophisticated thinkers, thoughtful practitioners must understand that these panics are the result of a convergence of many factors, some of which are always present in an economic setting. But it's the combination at the right moment, combined with a spark, that leads to the conflagration. I leave you with those seven factors to reflect on as we continue our discussion of the current crisis. Thank you.
So first of all, let me just say thanks to Eric and the Student Legal Forum for organizing the event. I guess there was a workshop or a panel a couple weeks ago on a similar topic. Maybe some of you were there. And the good news is that things change so quickly that we could probably have one of these things every 2 weeks for the next year, and there would still be enough new things to talk about. So I was asked to focus on some of the very current events. And let me try to just highlight a few recent developments, and then I'll turn it over to Dean Mahoney for some of his thoughts on the path forward. How should we think about this problem? Well, I was trained as a management consultant, and one of the techniques that we used to try to break apart very difficult problems was to divide the discussion into an assessment of the situation, the complication, and the resolution. Let me try it out here. Start with the current situation. It's pretty easy to summarize. It's bad. Well, how do we know this? There are at least three very thorny problems that we are trying to deal with simultaneously. The first is a collapse in paper wealth. And that manifests itself in both the stock market and in the housing market. From the stock market point of view, we've already hit a half-life, right? As of the day before yesterday, the price of shares are down 50% over their peak in 2007. This is compounded by a fall in the housing market. There was a report that came out today discussing how bad the housing market is. And I got to tell you, as someone who's trying to sell a house, it's not a very encouraging report. The report said three things. First of all, the overall monthly sales volume of homes was down the lowest it has been in 12 years. Second, the prices of the homes were down 15% on a year-over-year basis. And third, almost half of all the sales were distressed sales, so foreclosure-related sales. The combination of these paper losses is in part driving this unprecedented loss in consumer confidence. If you go out and you look at the consumer confidence surveys, they're now the lowest they've been in almost 40 years since we've been recording data on how people feel about the economy. The second problem is a breakdown in our financial markets. Financial stocks, I don't need to tell you, are wobbling. It got so bad that last Friday, Chris Sprigman walked into my office and said, George, I've got an idea. Let's go buy out Citigroup. Right? I mean, you know, we thought a little bit about it, and I said, sure. Unfortunately, the stock was up about 20% Monday, and so we've kind of waved that idea off. But the bad news keeps coming, right? AIG is a money pit. You know, they're going to report a $60 billion loss. They are only one ratings downgrade away from additional capital calls, and they're only two ratings rating downgrades away from a $50 billion acceleration event. Third problem, we have a global slowdown in economic development, in the production and the consumption of goods and services. And this is a global catastrophe. It's not a domestic one, right? You think things are bad here. Well, let me continue to give you a couple of stats. If we take the fourth quarter GDP, fourth quarter 2008 GDP, and we were to annualize it for, you know, for the 2009 in the U.S., what would it tell us? If we project that last quarter forward, it would say that we are going to face a GDP decline in the U.S. of about 3.8%. Well, guess what? That's nothing. In the U.K., if you do the same thing, the number is a 6% decline. In Germany, the number is an 8% decline. In Japan, the number is a 13% decline. In South Korea, the number is a 21% decline in GDP, if you continue at the level that we continued as in the last fourth quarter. This is bad. That's the situation. What's the complication? It could get worse. Why do I say that? Well, I mean, if nothing else, just look at the GDP numbers I mentioned a moment ago. We are not certainly as much of an export-driven economy as Japan or South Korea, but nevertheless, there's still a difference in a 3.8% GDP loss and some of the other numbers that other countries are seeing. Secondly, look at unemployment. We're maybe at about a 7.5% unemployment rate right now. Well, during the Great Depression, we were running at a 25% rate of unemployment. That's pretty scary. And finally, look at the stock market. I said we're at a half-life. We're down 50% from what the market was. But during the Great Depression, the stock market fell 90%. I think there's lots of other problems that we might see, right? Trade fights or, you know, international strife as these events continue to unfold. So what's the resolution? How are we dealing with these problems? Well, I turned on the TV last night to watch our president, and like some of you perhaps did, hoping for some clues about what we were going to do with respect to some of these problems. And it was a very nice speech, but it wasn't very detailed as far as some prescriptions as to what exactly we should be doing. Similarly, our Treasury Secretary Geithner was panned about a week ago for a lack of details on his specific plans to try to restore the financial markets. But there have been at least four interesting developments that have been proposed and I think are going to be rolled out over the next couple of weeks. So I'll just mention them very quickly as something that we should keep our eyes upon. The first thing is how to save the banks. How are we going to put in some capital injections to try to, you know, prop up our failing banks? Probably we're going to continue to see a policy of injecting federal money as preferred stock that potentially is going to be converted into common stock under the right circumstances. How do you know which banks need or should take the money? Well, Secretary Geithner said that we need to subject our banks to a stress test. You might think of this like when you go to the doctor, right, and he puts you on a treadmill and makes you walk really fast and then determines how fast your heart is beating to figure out if you're in good enough shape. How should the stress test work? What should we do in order to put these banks on the treadmill? And how fast should we run the treadmill in order to figure out if they're really healthy or not? Well, we just had an announcement not even 2 hours ago where the details of the stress test have finally come out. And basically what the government is going to do is it's going to take any financial entity or any bank, at least, that has more than $100 billion in assets, and it's going to put it on the treadmill. And it's going to run the treadmill at a base rate, and then it's going to run it at a bad scenario rate. I really didn't think they were going to reveal the numbers that they were going to use for the bad scenario, because I thought people were going to say, you know, oh, look at how bad it is, and that was going to, you know, cause some sort of fear. But they did. And here are the numbers that they're going to be using to try to let us know whether these banks are going to make it. They're going to try to assess the impact on banks if by 2010 we have a 10.3% employment rate, if home prices drop 22% in 2009 and 7% in 2010, and if GDP drops 3.3% in 2009 and 0.5% in 2010. Now, given the statistics that I just mentioned a moment ago, you might say, is that enough, right? Are we moving the treadmill fast enough in order to figure out whether banks really are going to be able to, you know, keep the heart beating in a healthy manner? What happens if they run the banks through the stress test and it turns out that their balance sheets are going to be lousy under their scenarios? Well, then the federal government is going to inject money. It's initially going to give the banks 6 months to try to raise private money, and after that it's going to, I think, mandate that they take some sort of federal money, probably in the form of preferred stock that ultimately might be converted into common stock. Three more quick problems, and then I'll conclude, or three more quick issues to look at as solutions, and then I'll conclude. The second thing we're trying to deal with is how to unfreeze the credit markets, right? I view this separately as trying to save the banks through these injections of private equity. We are looking at Fed plans where they are trying to issue loans backed by Treasury equity to kickstart financing in things that you probably care about, right? The student loan market, the car market, the housing market, so that you can actually go out and continue to get certain loans, or so that the commercial paper market will continue to work going forward. The third problem involves corralling toxic assets. We've heard a bit about good bank, bad bank proposals. We've heard a bit about a variety of proposals to try to say that I know what I'm investing in is actually a meaningful security. And there we still need some more details. We have a public-private plan that's been put out, so keep your eye on how exactly, if at all, that whole scenario is going to work. And finally, there is a plan put forth on foreclosure relief. Part of the problem certainly is this housing market, and there are a number of ideas that have been advanced about how to try to, you know, prevent and protect and basically re-accelerate the housing market. Ultimately, though, there's some really difficult questions to deal with for any plan that's going to try to jumpstart housing. So that's where we stand right now. Let me then turn it over to Dean Mahoney for his thoughts on where we may be going in the future.
So I was asked to specifically address some of the regulatory aspects of the problem and what we're likely to see going forward. And I think you have to talk about both of those things at the same time, because saying that we need to change regulations in a particular direction more or less implies that we're not doing it right currently. So I want to talk about a couple of aspects of financial regulation and how they might or might not have contributed to the current crisis. So one thing that you probably will recall hearing a lot during the presidential campaign was that deregulation was a big part of the sequence of events that led to the financial crisis. Typically, no one got any more specific than that, but if you dug down a little bit, a few of the things that were mentioned as being part of the problem were, one, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act of 1999, which repealed the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933. Glass-Steagall was the statute that separated commercial from investment banking. Graham-Leach-Bliley repealed that and allowed commercial banks to engage in full investment banking activities. Now, it's probably important to note that in fact, the Glass-Steagall barrier had been coming down for quite a long time before 1999. For what it's worth, I think that the demise of Glass-Steagall had nothing or virtually nothing to do with the current crisis. Most particularly, it's worth noting that the standalone investment banks, which were precisely the creatures created by Glass-Steagall that did not exist before Glass-Steagall, were the first ones to go under. And the ones that managed to survive, Goldman Sachs and so on, survived by converting themselves into commercial banks. So that one strikes me as really not terribly relevant. A second that's often mentioned is the Futures Modernization Act of 2000. I think the key thing, that amended the commodities futures laws in a variety of ways. I think the main thing to recognize there is it was more a response to the growth of the over-the-counter derivatives market than it was a cause of that market. So one could, in fact, believe that over-the-counter derivatives are a part of the problem, and I'll return to that in a minute, without believing that the Futures Modernization Act was part of the problem, because by and large, that was a reaction and not a cause of that growth. Largely, one of the key things it did is to provide a statutory blessing to pre-existing interpretations by the SEC and the CFTC that said that swaps, which are a form of over-the-counter derivative, were neither futures contracts nor securities. Another thing that has been much in the news and much discussed, as you've seen, is oddly enough, the Community Reinvestment Act, which was a statute from the 1970s that encouraged banks to lend more to low-income low-income neighborhoods, particularly to make mortgage loans in low-income neighborhoods. In the 1990s and in the current decade, there was increasing pressure on Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, which are the government, previously government-sponsored entities, now simply government entities, that buy up loans from banks to increase their holdings of loans made to low-income borrowers in low-income neighborhoods. And it turned out that Congress set targets that were sufficiently high for those holdings, that really the only way to meet them was for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to say to banks, look, we really don't much care what the loan-to-value ratio is. We pretty much don't care what the person's income is. We pretty much don't care what their credit score is. You've got to bring us enough loans so we can meet these congressional targets. So that is one of the things that led to the proportion of subprime loans as a fraction of all loans to increase substantially. Alan Greenspan recently said the subprime market essentially emerged out of the Community Reinvestment Act. Well, so what do we do, and how do we fix this? Certainly, I think one very simple point that I hope regulators have learned is that any set of policies or regulations that actively encourages banks not to apply sound underwriting standards when making loans is a bad policy and ought to be rethought. I think another issue that will be important going forward is capital ratios, which doesn't sound very interesting or exciting, but probably is going to be an important issue going forward. If you roll the clock back a little bit, what you would have seen is that entities that did business with the public, broker-dealers and commercial banks, were subject to capital requirements, which is a simple way of saying it limited the amount of borrowing they could do as a proportion of their total asset base. So it limited the amount of leverage they could take on. For banks, that was regulated both at the level of the bank itself that did business with the public and typically at the level of the holding company, which most large banks are owned by a holding company that is itself not regulated as a bank, that doesn't do business with the public, but it's also subject to capital requirements. When you go over to investment banks, it was slightly different. The broker-dealer, which does business with the public, was subject to capital requirements, but the holding company up at the top was not. One thing, again, that you've probably seen in the newspapers or on the blogs as here's part of what caused the crisis is a statement that the SEC suddenly in 2004 allowed investment banks to go from a 12-to-1 leverage ratio to a 40-to-1 leverage ratio. It turns out that's not exactly correct. The problem was before 2004, the holding companies were not subject to any limit on their leverage at all. And what the SEC did was as a way of starting to impose capital requirements on holding companies, decided to start pretty loosely and said, well, look, if you guys will voluntarily subject yourselves to capital requirements at the holding company level, we'll start it off at a nice, easy level to meet, which was 40-to-1. So that didn't, in fact, represent a loosening. It represented the first tentative attempt to bring the holding companies in. Well, going forward, there aren't going to be any investment banking holding companies because there aren't any investment banks left. They are all now commercial banks, and they will be subject to capital requirements as such. And I think that it is simply going to be important that any entity that plays an important role in the credit markets be subject to some form of capital regulation so that you don't have a situation like we had with the investment bank holding companies that didn't have any specific capital requirements. I want to turn back for a second to over-the-counter derivatives because one thing that I think was a potential contributing factor in the current crisis is the fact that if you or I were to pick up the phone and call up a broker and say, I'd like to trade a futures contract, whether it's pork bellies or oil or gold or you name it, we would enter into a contract that would technically speaking be made with a clearinghouse, which is simply to say there's a buyer and there's a seller of the contract, but the clearinghouse steps in and takes on the credit risk of each as to the other counterparty, so that if you are selling me orange juice futures, I don't have to worry about whether you're solvent or not. I only have to worry about whether the clearinghouse is solvent or not, because if you don't perform, I can look to the clearinghouse. In order to keep itself solvent, the clearinghouse requires us to put up what it's called margin, but really it's a performance bond. It's money that we put up that the clearinghouse can take if we don't perform, and that keeps the clearinghouse solvent. Well, if I were to do the same thing through an interest rate I would call it a commodity swap. I would just say, we're going to enter into a contract under which if the price of orange juice futures goes up, you have to pay me money, and if it goes down, I have to pay you money, and we do that not on any exchange. There's no clearinghouse. There's no margin. And if you're insolvent, that's a problem for me. Now everyone understood that, okay, in the over-the-counter market. But one complication that created that perhaps people didn't focus on quite as carefully as they should have is that means in a time of economic stress, every orange juice futures contract entered into on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange is worth exactly the same as every other one because the underlying credit is the clearinghouse. But in a time of economic stress, if we have done the same thing through a commodity swap that's not on an exchange, the value of the contract I entered into with you and the contract I entered into with you may not be worth the same because one of you may be solvent and the other one may not be. And that means it's pretty hard to figure out what these contracts in general are worth. That traditionally was not a very big issue because these contracts were by and large entered into with incredibly solvent entities that would never go bankrupt, like Lehman Brothers or AIG or Citigroup, and so no one worried about whether one with AIG was worth more than one with Lehman Brothers, et cetera. Well, now it matters a lot. Who your counterparty happens to be. So it may be that going forward, market participants and regulators may reassess the relative benefits of the flexibility and low transaction costs that come with over-the-counter derivatives versus the higher cost but greater immunization against counterparty risk that comes with exchange-traded derivatives with the centralized counterparty. So those are a couple of things that I would look for in regulatory developments going forward. Another thing I would look for is certainly it might make a lot of sense to reduce some of the cracks that that various activities can fall between because we have an SEC that regulates securities, a CFTC that regulates futures contracts, and if a very clever lawyer can come up with something that's not quite either, then it might not be regulated by either. Or, better yet, if you can play off one against the other, you might be able to cut a better deal. Similarly, we have state, federal banking regulators, etc. That one's going to be a harder problem to solve because every one of those regulators has its patron in either the House or Senate or in a state government who's not going to want to give up their patronage of that entity, whether it's the Senate Agriculture Committee with the CFTC versus the Banking and Finance Committee with the SEC or federal versus state regulators, et cetera. But one would like to think that there will be some effort devoted to trying to make sure that those cracks are tightened up. And I'll stop there so we can have plenty of time for questions.